from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, daylight maybe for a deal in deadlocked Washington. Economic jitters, political fallout, and a whole lot of Nobel Prizes out there. House Republicans feeling the heat over shutdown and default looked for daylight. Here's Majority Leader Eric Cantor laying it out before a White House meeting yesterday.
What we have discussed as a conference is a temporary extension of the debt ceiling in exchange for a real commitment by this president and the Senate Majority Leader to sit down and talk about the pressing problems that are facing all the American people.
But the House offer would leave the government shut down. Democratic Senator Harry Reid, majority leader there, wasn't having it. He spoke to reporters.
Republicans were pretty clear earlier today. They want to negotiate before you reopen the government. Is that
not going to happen?
Not going to happen, says Reid, and the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize goes straight to the heart of the chemical weapons challenge in Syria and beyond. Here's Norwegian Nobel Committee Chairman Torbjørn Jagland making the announcement.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2013 is to be awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of CBS News, Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see progress in Washington? Are you hopeful or not? How does this get resolved? With us from Washington right now is Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News and Correspondent at Large for National Journal. Major Garrett, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
From New York, Diane Brady is with us, Senior Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, welcome back to you as well.
Nice to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Diane.
Major Garrett, I'm going to come first to you in Washington. Where do things stand? It's very hard to sort out. Where are we right now on all this?
It is hard to sort out, Tom, and let me try to help people figure out where we are. The two sides are talking, and that's progress. Now, that ought not to be progress, but with the dysfunctional way that Washington has become, the aspect of talking itself takes on a kind of a celebratory air, though it probably ought not to. But they're not close to a deal, and that's what I think people need to understand. The markets were optimistic yesterday that at least in the terms of avoiding a government default scheduled to begin on October 17th, there was at least an admission that House Republicans, by House Republicans, that they had to bring an offer of what the president asked for, a no-strings-attached extension of government borrowing authority to avoid a default, and they chose 6 weeks, taking that up to November 22nd. But they also said to the president in a meeting at the White House yesterday afternoon, we'll give you that, but we want to keep the government closed. And the president said, look, I'm not going to avoid default and keep the government closed. My whole point in dealing with you on this is to avoid default and reopen the government. And then if you want to have conversations about other budget items or the health care law, those can commence then. But the sequencing is vital to the White House. Avoid default, reopen the government completely, then there can be conversations. House Republicans, though divided and dropping in the polls, still would like to extract, with the leverage they have of a feared default and a continuing government shutdown, some concrete concessions on budget policy from the White House. The White House insists those concessions will never be made. The White House believes it has the upper hand. The polls certainly indicate it, although I will tell you this, Tom, if you look at the polling data, the president is also suffering, just not nearly as catastrophically as Republicans are. So in that environment, the White House believes it's doing better, though it knows it's not prospering, and they want to beat the Republicans down completely on this question of ever in the future using either the threat of default or a government shutdown to extract concessions.
Not clear to me whether we're out of these woods or not yet here, but certainly the talking is going on. There's been so much on the line. Not least the U.S. economy, maybe more than that. Diane Brady yesterday, just on the basis of, hey, they're talking, the markets were up, Dow up 300-plus points. How sturdy is that Wall Street sense that we've got progress here on this gridlock?
Well, you know, I think in essence people are still nervous, but there is a sense that especially with regard to the debt ceiling, both sides have at least expressed an understanding that we cannot let that happen. So who stands down first and to what extent it's linked to a shutdown is an open question. But I do think the markets at least are starting to appreciate the fact that we are not going to continue to be, crowdsourcing these decisions on whether to pay our bills. We all understand the importance of getting through that debt ceiling debate. You know, which side backs down first, as I said, you know, is going to be an open question. But ultimately, I think the markets really are focused on the U.S. economy right now, which remains pretty sluggish. And, you know, they're just trying to figure out what's happening in Washington.
Diane, there has been the thought from no small number of Republicans, Tea Party Republicans in particular, that this was not such a problem for the economy, that we could go up to this line, even go over the default line or the debt ceiling, and we'd be all right economically. How's that taken on board by the business community?
Well, it's not true. So it's not just obviously a domestic debate. In this case, it's very much an international picture. And the fact that we even have this debt ceiling, I think, is quizzical to a lot of countries outside the U.S., that you have to go to Congress to get the money to pay what you owe. I think that it is, in fact, far more devastating than the government shutdown, which is an inconvenience. And it's obviously starting to really hurt, especially some of the social programs. But there's no question that the business community, we need to be seen to be good on our debt. We're already, I think, our reputation's been marred somewhat by how we've handled this crisis. I think the idea that we might actually make it a political decision whether or not we pay our bills is not a message you want to be sending to the rest of the world.
Tension within the Republican Party has been a big part of this story. And just over the last 24 hours, maybe you can still hear that. This was Speaker of the House John Boehner before the White House meeting yesterday, coming out of that caucus, talking about a plan to extend the debt ceiling for 6 weeks and talk with the president. Listen to the tone of Boehner.
What we want to do is to offer to the president today the ability to move a temporary increase in the debt ceiling in agreement to go to conference on the budget for his willingness to sit down and discuss with us a way forward to reopen the government and to start to deal with America's pressing problems.
But here's Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Republican, of course, who had that long speech on the floor of the Senate before we got all the way into this, saying just today that the last 2 months of near chaos in the U.S. government anyway may be the model for how we should move forward, he says, in reforming government, and in particular, still, Ted Cruz says, going after Obamacare. Here's Senator Ted Cruz today at the Values Voters Summit in Washington.
And I'm going to suggest a model for how we turn this country around in the next couple of years. And it is the model that we have been following together for the last couple of months to stop that train wreck, that disaster, that nightmare that is Obamacare.
Jack Beatty, I'm going to come to you, but first, Major Garrett, take us inside the GOP and these tensions. There's Ted Cruz even today saying what we've been in the midst of is the model.
Well, it's not an effective legislative model, Tom, and there is absolutely zero proof that the Ted Cruz methodology has any legislative validity. Period.
But what does it mean for anything going forward? If he's still holding that torch, John, they're going to have a vote in the House today. By the time some of our listeners hear that, they may have taken it. I mean, can John Boehner deliver, even for this six-week extension, a House vote?
Well, there is no question that House Republicans believe on a six-week extension, they have the votes to pass it in the House. What is unclear is if Senator Cruz or others who might be aligned with him, Mike Lee of Utah, possibly Rand Paul, but let's just take Ted Cruz for the moment, might try to filibuster that. Then you have a complication within the Senate and within Republican ranks. And that's been a division within Republicans, not just on tactics, but on overall methodologies and pursuits. And Ted Cruz, as you just heard, is still waving, if I could use the metaphor, the bloody red shirt of Obamacare in a vastly overplayed symbolic gesture to the Republican base, that Obamacare can be overturned. Obamacare cannot be overturned. The votes don't exist to do it, period. And every effort to overturn Obamacare, the way the legislature, the House and the Senate, and the presidency is currently constructed, is quixotic. And many Republicans now believe it's not only that, it's injurious and stupid, because you can't continue to pursue a strategy that has no legislative validity.
And yet a lot of Tea Party House members were elected on their claim that they would never vote to raise the debt ceiling. Jack Beattie, we've just got a minute before the break here. I'm sorry for that. We'll come back to you. But here's Ted Cruz saying what we've been in the midst of here, this kind of chaotic situation, still looks like the way forward to his goal. This is the model of Ted Cruz government.
It's a model of suicide, as the as John Podoretz, the friend of the Republican Party, wrote yesterday. This NBC Wall Street Journal poll today is just bad news for the Republicans. Of all things, it shows that the effect of their chaos has been a net increase of 8 points in the favorability of Obamacare. Cruz has succeeded to doing in trying to destroy Obamacare is raise support for it.
That doesn't mean that his hardcore supporters are ready to back off here. They've got tough, entrenched support in their home districts, Jack.
That's absolutely right. But that comes back to another metaphor that the Wall Street Journal was using in a cautionary note a few weeks ago. They said the trouble with kamikaze attacks is that the pilot usually dies.
Let's listen to some of the sound of this unresolved standoff. There's talking going on. As Major Garrett says, that's a big deal. Where it goes, we don't know yet. Here was Republican Congressman Pete Sessions of Texas saying he was hopeful, glad that people were talking.
You know what? We're going to try and work together tonight to see if we can come to an agreement. And if we can come to an agreement, then we're working well together.
Still skepticism from the White House. Here was spokesman Jay Carney. He called the Republican offer an encouraging sign, but said the White House would have to wait and see on the specifics.
I think we ought to see whether they're serious about putting the matches and the gasoline aside.
The matches and the gasoline, and what about the default? Here's Carney again.
I mean, if there's a recognition that we can't default, why is there an insistence or the implication that you keep the nuclear weapon in your back pocket to threaten default in the near term?
And what about keeping the government shut down during talks? Here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid after the meeting with President Obama yesterday.
We want the government open. We want to be able to pay our bills. This is a situation where they do not know what they want. I hope the Republicans decide what they want, and we'll be happy to work with them in any way.
But not with a government shutdown. Here's Skeeter in Huntington, Vermont. Skeeter, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that the Republicans are now deciding to at least ease up on their stance only after polls show that they're getting hammered. But there was one poll that didn't get as much publicity as the one from Gallup, and that was a public policy polling poll that showed that if the 2014 midterm elections were held now, as many as 17 Republicans could go down to defeat. And most of those Republicans are in the mid-Atlantic states of the Northeast, the Midwest, and the West Coast. And most of those Republicans are traditional conservative to moderate Republicans, what few moderate Republicans there are.
Yeah, of course. There's a threat. It may be there. They may be feeling that. Others may feel protected and dug in. I mean, we'll talk about that, Skeeter. I appreciate your call on that front. I mean, from the GOP realm, you can hear all kinds of pushes here, and they're not all for talks, for let's make a deal. Here was Rush Limbaugh yesterday pushing back against the new GOP plan to raise the debt ceiling without extracting concessions.
I fear that we are getting ready to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory here. They're back to the original proposal I first heard about on Monday. House Republican leaders are pushing a 6-week increase in the debt limit without any conservative strings attached.
Rush Limbaugh saying don't snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. But here's former Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele talking with Chris Matthews on Thursday, responding to the new poll numbers showing that the GOP is falling in voters' opinion.
The country is pissed, and they're pissed at us. And now we've got to do something with this going forward. And if we don't, this gets worse. There's more bottom to hit before it gets better.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in those poll numbers? What are the numbers?
Well, the worst one probably is that the public, by 22 points, blames the Republicans over President Obama for the shutdown. And that, according to the poll, that margin is worse than the spread in 1995-96 on the last government shutdown. So that's really bad. Now, of course, the Democrats aren't usually popular either at 39%, but that's a lot better than the Republicans at 24 or the Tea Party at 21. So the numbers are just as bad as they could be by the Republicans. The question for the Republicans, the question is, will this, as you say, chasten that minority in the party that, well, there were 80 Republicans who signed a letter earlier in September, actually, saying, shut the government down if we can't, as a means of changing and holding back or if not destroying Obamacare. Those 80, they've been called the Suicide Caucus by Charles Krauthammer. They represent about 18% of the population, but they are so deeply dug into those districts. They won by double digits, I think, on the average. The president lost those districts by strong double digits. Will this dose of political reality affect them and chasten them? It really remains to be seen.
Major Garrett, NBC and the Wall Street Journal did this poll. I heard the NBC pollster saying these were historic bad numbers for the GOP here. What's most striking to you in these latest poll numbers, and how much impact do you think they'll have on Republican positioning in this whole back and forth?
Well, as I mentioned before, Tom, when you don't have the votes, you can't project a legislative strategy. That's always been a central impediment for Republicans. And now the polling data that shows them that their efforts, which were never going to succeed in the first place, are finding disfavor in the public, are adding another level to their calculus. And their surrender is now being planned. They just haven't announced all the terms of it. And they have to surrender because they don't have the votes and they're losing the public debate. But the president is also suffering. His poll numbers, according to several surveys this week, are in the high 30s, at the best low 40s, which are historic lows for President Obama as well. Also, there was a poll this week that suggested, or that showed, a Gallup poll, the lowest level of satisfaction with the government since Watergate. Okay, since Watergate. That means the public itself was so dissatisfied with all sectors of government. Trust in the president's down. Trust and believability in Congress is down. All of government institutions are suffering as a result of this dysfunction. Republicans are suffering more, but no one in the grand scheme of things can argue credibly that they are benefiting from this stalemate.
But Major, take us into the GOP dilemma here, because I have to admit, I am still, I mean, you say these numbers and that what's happening is going to force a change. I'm not sure. There's a no-surrender caucus here. You hear Rush Limbaugh saying it was going in the right way. Ted Cruz still saying that. I mean, take us inside. How do you actually change the votes inside the House GOP? And you mentioned the potential for filibuster in the Senate there. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you? They're saying we won't let up on the shutdown. Obama's saying, I won't talk if there's still a shutdown. More or less, Reid explicitly saying that. How do we actually get past the impasse that we've been at?
Well, I obviously I can't predict that with any certainty. I can tell you the kind of things that may ultimately work out. First of all, by Republicans saying they'll avoid default and extend the government's borrowing authority without strings attached is an enormous concession. And it basically tells the country and the markets that default will not occur. All right.
But there is a string attached. The government stays shut down.
Well. But these conversations have now been melded starting this morning, that they're all coming together. And so you could have an agreement on a one-year extension of all government funding to reopen the government, have a number that all sides have to swallow that they don't love, a little bit higher than the ones Republicans want to spend, a little bit lower than the ones the Democrats have passed in the Senate, and the one the president might reluctantly have to accept to keep reopen the government and keep it funded for the next full fiscal year. Then Republicans can have a conversation about extending the debt ceiling, meaning providing the government a borrowing authority to avoid default, and then in that 6-week or 8-week or whatever the agreed-upon number of weeks is, the president and Senate Democrats can agree to have a conversation, but no agreement on concessions on things like the Keystone Pipeline and maybe a framework for tax reform. Those are some of the ideas that I've also heard, possibly throwing in a removal of the medical device tax.
Diane, I hear you there.
I want to just I think one of the things that we want to see right now is for our president to be acting a little more presidential. And you want to see him get above the partisan politics. And I think, in essence, you know, to stop openly blaming Republicans, Boehner, et cetera, I think there has to be some element of face saving here. And one of the things that stood out to me in the poll is the fact that the public understands more than they did 2 years ago the dire consequences of not raising the debt ceiling. So that's a powerful message, I think, that the public has sent. And now I think it's incumbent upon Obama to really give the GOP, at the very least, some of the optics that it's not a total defeat here.
But where's the face-saving, Diane? On government shutdown, Harry Reid says, no way we're going to talk if they leave the government shut down. On default, the president has said he learned a lesson last time. That's a losing game, and he's not going to negotiate around that again. On the talks themselves, maybe everybody's willing to talk a little bit about entitlements, but maybe not in the same way. And the president has always said he will only act if there's also new revenues. That is, you know, one way or another, more taxes on the wealthy. Where's the room for face-saving give here, Diane?
I think what he has to do, first of all, is resolve the issue of a default. And so if that 6 weeks, I mean, this is the gift that keeps on giving, we'll have to revisit it in 6 weeks. But that, I think, has to basically be separated out. And it's the president, in essence, who has to give something to the GOP in terms of not, you know, if we have to continue having the shutdown, then, you know, we'll have to continue it. But that is job one right now, is to send that message and to send it powerfully. In terms of, I think ultimately what has to happen is he just can't overplay his hand. He can't press for a total victory. And I think what happens is he has to, at least the rhetoric has to change a bit. Ultimately, you know, will he, do we have to stop this shutdown? Yes, we do. But I think we have to, first of all, get a clear message on what's happening October 17th, because that's what the markets are worried about.
Jack, can the president go with a government shutdown for 6 more weeks? I mean, we're getting out by Thanksgiving at that point, and who knows if we even have a solution then. And what about the you should not go for total victory argument here? I know there are Democrats. I mean, I'm reading here in the reports now that say, look, the GOP's on the run. Indeed, let's go for total victory.
Yeah, I think the temptation of total victory is a mistake. I mean, politics is the art of letting your opponent, helping him off those branches he's dutifully sawing in half, and that he's on. You know, I think that the president could lose support from his own party if he caves on the government shutdown. You just can't have headlines like, quote, I'm quoting some, food safety inspectors suspended, families left without baby food, nuclear plant employees furloughed, scientific research on hold. If that goes on for 6 weeks, and they'll get worse because this is cumulative, people have been working and they're not going to have the money to do any more. You know, they've been shuffling things around to try to keep a skeleton staff on in many departments. The president will lose support from his own base. Now, Major says he hasn't done well in the polls. That's true. But NBC does show a slight tick up for him from 45 to 47. But that is Democrats coming home. He had lost Democrats badly in September over Syria. He had been down beneath 80% with Democrats. And if he essentially caves on the condition of keeping the government open and talks to the Republicans about the debt ceiling, in the face of headlines like this, he will lose his own support in his party.
Beth in Niskayuna, New York. Beth, thanks for calling.
Hi. Okay, so I'm going to put it this way. I'm listening to NPR when I'm driving around, and I'm hearing furloughed workers complain that they won't be able to pay for their kids to go to college out of state. And if that's what's happening, shut the government down. I do not want to hear that in comparison to food stamps or anything else.
The government is shut down already. You say leave it there because why?
They shut down. If I'm paying for some kid to go to private college out of state, if that's what my money's going towards, Keep it shut down.
What about default? I mean, everybody says if we...
I don't care. I am outraged that I am paying for some kid to go to a fancy college. Not one kid, I'm sure. I'm guessing there's whole segments of this government that could shut down the research. It's animal research anyway. I'm tired of it. I can barely afford to eat. And I'm being told that I'm going to pay million-dollar contracts for Nancy Pelosi's husband, that I'm going to pay for a bunch of kids to go to private colleges that I could never dream of going to. Let it stay shut down.
Shut it all down. Bring on the deluge, Beth. We've got it. I mean, you get economic stress out there, and people start going in all kinds of directions. Beth says, shut it down. Let me get one more. Thank you, Beth. Jim in Providence, Rhode Island. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have one basic question. I keep hearing about poll numbers. Who's taking the most hit on the shutdown and debt ceiling? Why should anyone be concerned about the president's poll numbers? He's not running for office again. I mean, he's finished running for office. So why would the president be concerned about his poll numbers?
What about leadership? I mean, how do you lead if you're not paying attention to what the public thinks and even the other party?
Yeah, I understand, but it would seem to me that he's in the best position of all.
So what should he do? You mean just go with exactly what he thinks is right and damn the torpedoes?
Absolutely. I mean, his poll numbers to me are irrelevant because he's all done running for office.
Jim, thanks for your call. Major Garrett, listen to that right there. You know, from one side, let it all burn down. From the other side, president, don't give an inch. I mean, there's still public sentiment out there that's polarized, too.
Sure, and this gives me an opportunity, Tom, to talk about two pieces I wrote for National Journal this week, comparing this shutdown to 1995, which I covered and wrote an extensive book about. And there are two, and these two callers exemplify two things that are very, very different about 1995 and now. Let's take the last caller. What was Bill Clinton's political situation in 1995? He was in the first term, facing re-election.
Yep.
And though he won the politics of the shutdown, he compromised consistently with Republicans on key budget policy. He went from never a balanced budget to one in 10 years, finally to one in seven with congressional numbers.
And figured he probably had to because he needed
because
to be reelected.
Yep. Now let's go to the economy. And the earlier caller saying shut it all down. They're so frustrated with their economic situation. In 1995, at the end of the shutdown in January, the unemployment rate in this country was 5.7%.
Mm-hmm.
GDP that quarter... first quarter of 1996, which is after both shutdowns, the one in November and the one that went into January a little bit, was 2.7%. In the second quarter of 1996, it was annualized at 7%.
Zooming.
Our economy was in much, much better shape, and it was on the cusp of an even better era of the dot-com boom and all the federal revenues that came from that made every future budget deal and then eventual surpluses so much easier to achieve. Negotiating in the politics of economic plenty is far easier than negotiating in the politics of economic stagnation, which is what we have now, and dividing up less is much harder politically than dividing up more.
Boy, I am definitely not sure that we're out of the woods in spite of all the talk about daylight and talking. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius appeared on The Daily Show to talk about Obamacare's very rocky rollout and got grilled by Jon Stewart.
We're going to do a challenge. I'm going to try and download every movie ever made. And you're going to try and sign up for Obamacare, and we'll see which happens first.
Okay.
Good luck, Madam Secretary. An undercover NYPD detective is arrested for allegedly taking part in that attack on an SUV driver by a pack of motorbikers in New York City.
And yet another twist tonight. Police say one of the bikers was an off-duty undercover narcotics cop. They say he did not intervene when the assault was happening for fear of blowing his cover.
And Scott Carpenter, the second U.S. astronaut to go into orbit back in 1962, died at 88. Here he is last year on why NASA hasn't ventured deeper into space, and in 1962 in his big launch from Cape Canaveral, feeling the liftoff.
The reason we are not pursuing diligently to the moon and eventually Mars is because we haven't figured out yet how to energize the public.
1-0. I feel the liftoff. The clock has started.
Roger.
The right stuff. Let's have it still. We're looking at a week in the news, maybe an opening on shutdown pain and default fever. Tough poll numbers for Republicans. Not so pretty for the president, I guess. Nobel Prizes and terror raids. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you hopeful on a resolution to the country's shutdown and debt ceiling crisis? Will the Nobel Prize help get chemical weapons cleaned up in Syria? Were you rooting for Malala Yousafzai there? What do you say to the first female head of the Fed, Janet Yellen? What do you think of the U.S. terror raids in Africa? Cutbacks for Egypt? The motorcycle gang mess? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Let's hear from a few more callers out in Washington State. Jane's calling from Pasco, Washington. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm so glad you took my call. I've got so many things that I would like to comment on that I've heard this morning. It's like this when you saw Clue, this Mrs. Black was flames. Anyways, I will get to the point that I would like to address. Earlier this week, you had a lady on by the name of Katrina Pearson.
Christine Pearson.
Tea Party.
Yeah, and she's challenging Pete Sessions, who we heard from today in Texas. Yes.
Yeah, she said a few things that I would just like to address and things that I've heard a few times. And it was basically she said that the Republicans gave Obama a blank check for the first four years of his presidency. And I would just like to say, Katrina, I guess you really don't understand the realism. On the night of Obama's inauguration, a group of Republicans got together to discuss how they were going to make their party relevant again. It was at the Steakhouse in D.C. Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Newt Gingrich, John McCain, Jim DeMint, and Kevin McCarthy all got together because they were so depressed as to where their party was going to go. This was a veritable who's who of the Republican Party. They were despondent and depressed because they thought that their party was going
to
be a minority party for decades.
Cut to the chase. What do you have to say here?
Okay. 3 hours after they finished this meeting, they emerged triumphant and almost jubilant because they had a plan, and the plan was to block everything that the Obama administration was going to, every legislation initiative that they were going to put forward, they were going to say no to.
Jane, we've got it. We can tell the point, not a yarn, but I think we've got the point of it. And, yeah, that idea has been in the background here throughout. Just say no. A lot has been said no to, but Obamacare went through. People still trying to push, before that, people trying to still turn that one around. Let me get another here. Joellen in Bennington, Vermont. Joellen, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yep.
So this is in response to the woman from New York who called earlier saying shut the government down because
yep.
I heard somebody griping that I won't be able to afford my kids out-of-state college tuition.
Yep.
I'm wondering if she was referring to the two Republican House Representatives members, Lee Miller's one and the other one's Renee something, who were complaining that they needed to be able to collect their paychecks because one of them specifically mentioned paying for his kids' college.
So you think it was House Republicans, not out-of-work federal workers. That puts a different cast on it, but sure, it had Beth ready to burn it all down. Yeah, you may be right, Joellen. I don't know the background of that one, but I appreciate your call. David in Charlotte, North Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment was also in reference to Beth, who was, about the college tuition. I am a federal worker who has experienced this up close and personal, as well as, several members of my family who work for various factions of the government. This is not, basically, in my opinion, not a political issue anymore as far as party. It's a group of people who are basically fighting over a football on a playground. This is short of fiscal, financial terrorism on the part of Congress acting on the federal worker.
What's the impact on you and others, David, on you?
I got my pay stub today for my paycheck that I'll get on Tuesday, which covers up till September 30. I am taking home less than half of what I normally take home in a two-week pay period. I commute 117 miles to my federal job each way. Every day of the week. And I am still required to come to work with no paycheck. I am one of the essential personnel.
How about we do this for 6 weeks more, David? What do you think of that? 6 more weeks of talking about it.
I think you're going to have anarchy and you're going to have to declare, military rule because I'll tell you what, 6 more weeks of this? This is ridiculous. And to extend funding of the government for 6 weeks, you put it out until, at the very least, January or February. You know, great timing with the holidays coming up.
We are in strange territory here, David, but I appreciate your call. Diane Brady, what about the impact? I know your number one concern is debt ceiling and default. I mean, that kind of has been described as a catastrophic option. But what about just the government shutdown for it? I mean, the way these things go, if it's 6 weeks possible, it's very likely to be 6 weeks. What's the economic impact of that? Is that all right?
No, I think it is devastating. And I think also, you know, we get mired in the weeds sometimes with this debate as to whether or not federal workers are paid too much or not. That's not the issue. I think that, among other things, it's a farcical showdown to the rest of the world in terms of how our government is operating right now. And the other reality is the business climate is dependent on how much people are buying. It's not about what's happening in the 202 area code. You have people who are not being paid. You've got tourism being crimped. I was at JFK this week. The lines were huge, especially for foreign visitors. So we're sending a very powerful message as to how this country operates. And the reality is government, yes, costs us money, but government also, I think, brings in money because we have now museums and parks and a lot of, you know, what sort of the lubricant that keeps this economy operating depends on federal spending. So it is devastating. Nobody wants 6 more weeks of this. It's just that we need something to budge because, you know, there's a lot right now hinging on debt, but clearly the shutdown's devastating too.
James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Good morning. How are you doing today?
Okay. What do you think, James?
Well, I got a couple questions. One is, if the debt ceiling is so important to be raised and opening up the government is so important to get people back to work, why can't the Democrats blink? And also, if Obamacare is already funded in law, then the bill of defunding it coming from the Republicans, why can't the Democrats accept that since it's already funded and enacted? It doesn't make a difference. So how come the Democrats can't blink if the people of America are so important? It comes back to the point that the president of the United States is ideologically fighting for one particular thing and not concerned about the American people and the American economy.
Jim, I'll let the president speak for himself in a minute, but what about the fact that he was reelected? It was passed by both houses of Congress. It was signed off on by the Supreme Court. I mean, we've been around this track, but what about all that?
Well, the point is, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican. I vote on principle, and I did vote for Obama, but I did not vote for Obama for Obamacare. He ran on several platforms, and one of those was the environment, and that's what I was hopeful for, that we improve the environment.
James, I hear it. Let's put the president here, right here. He had a press conference on Tuesday, and he talked about exactly this point. Here's the president, his own words.
To all the American people, I apologize that you have to go through this stuff every 3 months, it seems like. And Lord knows I'm tired of it. But at some point, we've got to kind of break these habits and get back to the point where everybody understands that in negotiations, there is give and there is take. And you do not hold people hostage or engage in ransom taking to get 100% of your way.
Major Garrett, where do you see the possibility of a blink, if that's what you want to call it, on the Democratic side here? And what about on the Republican side now? The Tea Party seemed to have the whip hand here for several weeks. Ted Cruz, again, still out there today, quoting from him, he was heckled heavily at this values voter meeting. But he said, in my view, the House of Representatives needs to keep doing what they're doing, which is standing strong. He said America may have only a couple years to turn things around or risk going off the cliff to oblivion. He's not backing down. So where's the blink on each side here?
Well, let me take the caller's question. Why can't the Democrats blink? Well, now, I will only articulate what the Democrats have said and tell you the numbers that are behind that. You can decide for yourself whether this is a concession or not. But on the question of reopening the government for 2 months, there is a number of what would be spent on all government services for those 2 months. It's $986 billion. That is the Republican number. The Senate would have a number considerably higher than that. The Senate is, of course, run by Democrats. House Democrats don't like that number. One of the reasons they don't like that number
is... What is that number again, Major? What is it?
$986 billion. That would be over for the full year, but it is amortized for 2 months.
And what do you mean? That's okay? The cost of being shut down, or what is that?
No, savings? That's what would be spent. That would be the allocation of government spending for all government services for 2 months. Not $986 billion for 2 months, but that would be for the full year, less the 2 months. So that's the number. Just hold on to that number for a second. That's a Republican number, okay? And that also would continue sequestration for a second year of across-the-board spending cuts, which the president opposes, Senate Democrats oppose, and House Democrats oppose. Now, Democrats have said, we hate that number. We think it's far too low. It's completely in conflict with what the president says needs to be done on various aspects of federal spending to advance economic growth, but they'll take it. So from the Democratic perspective, and you can agree or disagree, I'm just telling you what Democrats think about this, although as to whether or not they've blinked, they believe they have blinked on this number, because they know if you accept that number for 2 months, Republicans are in a legislative position to argue in the future that that number should be the baseline.
Of reduced government spending. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Should be just slightly higher than that. And so Democrats believe that they have, on the fundamental of day-to-day government spending, have made a concession to Republicans by accepting a number that's much lower than they want and that they passed in the democratically controlled Senate. So they believe they have come a distance toward Republicans on the question of not only how to reopen the government, but at what level of funding the government would be reopened. And it's a Republican number.
That doesn't leave a whole lot more room for blink. We're looking at quite a week. Pam in Somerset, Kentucky. Pam, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. I believe that there are at least 20 million children going to bed hungry every night. I may not have that exactly, but I doubt their numbers anyway. I bet it's more than that. Just like there's no inflation, except for food and gas. But if you started out talking about progress, can progress be made in the negotiations going on? The only progress that I see that can be made is to stop the Tea Party from taking away more and more from us, and Obama going along with it, which is what it sounds like he's doing, he's going to do, including Keystone, and that we have to stop the total attack on poor people in this country, poor working poor, lower middle class. We have to stop this because Obama, I think, is getting ready to cave again.
So there's the stand strong, Mr. President word from Somerset, Kentucky. Pam, thanks very much for that. Jack Beatty, I mean, historically, how are we getting into ahistoric territory here? Nick Kristof was looking back to the pre-Civil War years unsettlingly this week to find this tone, these kind of positions. He wrote, the way politicians seek leverage by brazenly threatening deliberate harm to the nation unless they get their way. I mean, politics has always been tough in this country, but are we in some kind of extraordinary zone?
It certainly feels that way, doesn't it? We had an expert on polarization on our program a while ago, Nolan McCarthy. He and his colleagues have done a computer printout of analysis of all votes cast in Congress since the 1870s. And he finds that polarization now is just about where it was, as bad as it was, in the 1870s. Well, what was going on then? Well, the country had just had a catastrophic civil war, and it was trying to knit together, and the issue of should African Americans be enfranchised, what sort of life should they have, that was right at the center of American politics. And there are some people who think that something similar way back here in the motivation is involved, namely that that there's a minority of white Americans who just feel their whole status is threatened, that the world is changing around them, and that the Tea Party in some way, with its stop everything, its kind of reactionary conservatism, that accurately reflects that sentiment. Stop these changes that are threatening not our economic viabilities, isn't a conflict of interest, but our status, our sense of importance, our place in the world, and that President Obama is in some way emblematic of that.
That would be
if that's the case, that's a tough thing to resolve.
That would be back to the Alamo. Diane Brady, Janet Yellen, first woman to lead the Fed named this week. What kind of reception are you hearing?
Well, I think it's overdue. I mean, this was a very drawn-out process, you remember, with Larry Summers and mm-hmm. such. And so I think she's a very welcome voice. You know, this is somebody who's been there at the helm. It is a democracy. She's not a dictator. She has to get everybody else on board. And it certainly the markets greeted it in a very positive way, which is she's a professional. She's somebody who really did sort of make the right decisions during the crisis. And she's also a relatively calm voice, I think, certainly compared to Larry Summers, and somebody who will, I think, get the right message out to the markets.
We're thinking about South Dakota this week in the aftermath of that huge autumn blizzard last week, killed so many cattle out there. Very unusual. Thinking about that strange motorcycle encounter in New York. Guys out riding, and that conflict and the beating of the, what was some kind of banker in the SUV. That you don't want to see more of. I don't know what was going on there, criminal or class or you name it, but that was an unsettling thing for the whole country. And now we will watch as Washington maybe sits down to try and work out the crisis we've been in the midst of. To my guest today, our thanks for helping us peer into these thorny thickets. Major Garrett, White House correspondent for CBS News, thank you very much for being with us, Major.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Diane Brady, Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, follow us online at onpointradio.org. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.